Enterprise. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and at this time we start the TechNet on Landmark. For those who haven't heard it before, and I hope there's very few of those, the TechNet meets every Sunday evening. It's the gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about radio equipment. How does it work? How does it make it work better? There's 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. And the 2-meter FM ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of those kinds. Let me drop. And the other kinds of ham radio, you can try them. If this one doesn't please you, certainly try one of the others. Arguably one of the most educational hobbies there is. Something a little bit different is going to happen tonight. You guys are going to get a mini lecture on the subject of radar. John received an extremely interesting mailbag request question this week. He gave me some forewarning about it, and I suddenly realized that the subject of radar is one of the radio subjects of an extremely exciting field, a very unique piece of equipment that arguably has done some extremely good work over the last 60 years or so. So some of the ins and outs of radar you're going to be hearing about, because I have experienced radar for my 40 years of my experience. So I'm going to be telling you my experience with radar, which some very unique pieces of radar equipment I had a chance to work on. So I know that Hal has said from time to time, K6DPZ, that we should give lectures that are announced ahead of time. So please tell Hal that I'm going to be giving a lecture tonight at around 9 o'clock on the subject of radar. The person who does have a question or a comment for the TechNet signs in by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means he does have a question or a comment. The actual group of people who run the TechNet are K2LIW, Dick, you're listening to him, John, KC2WGV. He handles the mailbag and also monitors Echo Link, so that if you have trouble signing in by way of us not giving enough of a gap, let me drop. By us not giving enough of a gap between our transmissions, John will know about it, and there's ways that you can actually communicate over the internet to John, the fact that you're trying to get in, or he will know about that. That's also followed by Paul WS2N, who is our space expert. He'll be giving us space report number 166 tonight. You're listening to TechNet number 1573, would you believe, 33 years ago this month, September of 1982. Is when the TechNet began. So TechNet's been around a while. That's the reason why you need not sign in to say that you're listening. After 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So we take primarily people who do have questions or comment. So now's the right time to do that. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WY2U, Mike and Yes. I hope Mike does sign in more often. So give me your call letter and name right now if you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW listening.
Yes.
Yes. I heard two of them, and I'm hearing you on the input. So please repeat the last two calls. K2LIW. Okay, I heard Bravo Mike Papa. I heard Steve, KD2HUC. I think there was another one.
I'm A2OYY Joe, yes.
Okay, so far I've picked up, other than Steve, HUC, I've picked up Joe, BMP. I think I picked up John, IXP. And Joe, R-Y-Y. Did I miss anybody? Give me your call letter's name right now. K2-R-I-W, the tech man.
T-Y-T.
I think I heard T-Y-T. Would you give me that call again? K2-R-I-W.
Hilo Charlie 2.
Go 2. just one other call trying to get in. Give me your call letters again. Keisha Raleigh, W.
Alpha.
Kilo.
Charlie 2.
Juliet. I heard Kilo Charlie 2, Papa blank. Please repeat that call. KQRIW.
Repeat the call. I can hear you on the input. KC2WGB.
Kilo. Roger. Alpha.
Dick Rogers' call, I believe, is K2JAS, if I got it right.
Affirmative. Got it right. Yes.
Okay, we've got the Roger, K2JAS. There was a Kilo Charlie 2 Papa something. I'd like him to give it another try. Starting right now.
Thank you. Bye, Yankee.
On that one, I got KC2 Papa Nancy, it sounded like. Did not get the last letter. We'll let him try again.
I thought it was Papa Yankee.
P-Y-T.
We got it that time. Papa Yankee Tango.
Right, okay.
Okay, so Papa Yankee Tango, we've got you. And, okay, so Steve, Joe BMP, Joe RYY, Papa Yankee Tango, Roger JAS, and there was an IXP, which I don't think we've gotten yet. Anyone else who's trying to check in, give me a call letters and name right now. K2LAW and the TechNet. I'm going to hang on for a second until the net clears a little bit.
W3NH, Whiskey 3 November Hotel. I can check in for 50 minutes, then I'll need to secure.
Whiskey 3 November Hotel. Please tell us your name, sir.
In Whiskey Echo November, located in Birmingham, Alabama. I don't have any topics of interest, but I did want to check in and listen, of course.
Okay, glad to hear that. I know that Joe wanted to give an announcement. Give a brief transmission first, Joe. Let's make sure that you're coming through the machine. W2BMP, K2LIW. Go right ahead, Joe.
Screening deck. Let's see if I can get through this evening.
About 30% of the time, Joe. I'm hearing you very loud on the input. Anything you can do to increase your power would be useful, Joe.
Yeah, better. Why don't you go ahead, Dick, and I'll try for a minute.
Okay, yeah. Joe, I'm hearing a sound in the background like you've got a DMR machine turned on. Is there a piece of equipment like that running in your shack?
Negative, sir.
Okay. Let's start off with Steve first. KD2 HUC, K2RW. Go right ahead, Steve. I'll be hearing you on the input.
Equipped answers for the TechNet.
Yeah, I've already announced that Hal's going to be giving the quick answers, and I wanted to make sure, Hal, that you knew that I've told people ahead of time that I'm going to be giving a lecture tonight on the subject of radar at around 9 o'clock. And you wanted that to be announced ahead of time, and it is. Okay, so let's see if we can hear Steve. KD2HUC, K2RAW. Go right ahead, Steve.
Good evening, Dick. My question tonight is in regards to grounding. I have been doing a lot of work in installing a 40-foot mast, and I'm moving quite a rapid pace. My question is that I used to have a lightning protection bus in my basement, and the base of the tower is going to be, and I've created a new bulkhead to come in. From an RF issue with having multiple places at the same point, that kind of stuff. So that's my question.
Okay, I'm hearing Steve very well on the input, so I heard his whole question. 40-foot mast, which grounding bus he's got for lightning protection. When it comes to grounding, there's at least two or three reasons that we do grounding. Number one is for lightning protection, number two is for human safety, and number three, in some cases, is for better RF performance. Let's talk about the first one. The lightning that's going to strike your antenna, you'd like it to have a nice short path to ground, and that kind of grounding is kind of important. Although, the chances of your antenna being struck by lightning directly are rather remote. There's almost always trees and other things nearby. If you were a lightning bolt looking at your particular property top view, so to speak, you'd be seeing all of the Con Ed and Loco wiring. You'd be seeing lots and lots of trees. There's a zillion targets out there. And for your target to be the one that's being hit is rather unlikely. I've got 300-foot land and a 100-foot high tower, so that I'm the tallest thing around. And I've been here for 49 years. My antenna was struck with lightning once, and because of the grounding, I had some damage to computing equipment in the house, but none of the radio equipment was damaged. So lightning is a kind of a rare thing, though we do worry a lot about it. Let me drop. And the second reason that we do grounding is for human safety. If anything goes wrong with that third prong in the wall that brings your neutral or the grounding of your instrument panel, of your fuse panel to the equipment, and if something really went bad, back in the days when we used to have only two prong plugs, and if one of those prongs, which is the hot lead from Con Ed or Loco, happened to touch your chassis, and then you put your hand on the coax cable, the chassis, or whatever, and touch any other grounding object, like a water pipe, then there'd be 120 volts AC between you and those two hand contacts, and that wouldn't be good. So grounding there is rather important. The third reason for grounding, people think that grounding is going to help a standing wave ratio situation, almost never. They think grounding is going to make radio performance of the antenna work better. Very rarely. Let me drop on that one.
That because I got to run.
Okay. Hal's got to run, so he's going to give us his opinion on grounding. Go ahead, Hal.
First, I want to say hi to everybody on the net. Older wire cords. Get over to a three wire. The reason is the power transformer. You have no protection by a cord. You have to use your backplate pieces. So on a 520 to 60s, so they have just two wire pieces around the channel. There's a weak side of it. The point on K60.
Hal, at a later time, you're going to have to repeat that pronouncement you just made. The information you just gave us, unfortunately, 10 or 15% of it came through. So at a later time, you're going to have to repeat that. What portions of it that I was able to hear on the input, I'll try to repeat, and that is the three wire prongs that we've got on our plugs of our equipment. That round pin is the real one that's supposed to be very well grounded, and that's the one that gives you the safety. That's the one that gives you the safety for making sure your equipment is well grounded. The radio equipment grounding, in other words, in order to make your antenna transmit well, lots and lots of people think an antenna is not going to transmit well if it's not well grounded. The only slight exception to that one where grounding is somewhat important, in my opinion, is a quarter-wave ground plane antenna that you set up in the backyard if you don't have a very large number of ground plane radials. There, the so-called ground, the counterpoise, is an integral part of the antenna that's very important. Let me try to get a beep here. So, in the case of the quarter-wave ground plane antenna, local grounding does make a difference. But the majority of the antennas we use are thoroughly anti-metric device. Dipole, for instance, that's part of the driven element of your Yagi, or a dipole antenna that you use in yourself. It is its own counterpoise, as long as you've got the right kind of a balancing device antenna. Say at one end time the right side of the antenna is the radiator and the left side is the counterpoise. On the next half cycle, it's the other way around. So on thoroughly balanced, whether or not the antenna structure is well grounded has very little to do with the way it radiates, its radiation efficiency. Lots and lots of people think that the grounding is going to create an improvement in the case of television interference. They think it's going to make an improvement in a symmetric antenna's performance. Dipole-like antennas, which are thoroughly symmetric, whether or not it's grounded, makes very little difference. So the grounding situation radio-wise is highly misunderstood, in my opinion. Not everybody's going to agree with this. That's my experience. Maybe that's some of the answer you're looking for, Steve. And if not, you're allowed to ask the question again. KD2HUZ, K2LIW in the TechNet. I'll be hearing you on the input, Steve, so don't worry.
In question.
Okay, Dick. My question is, the grounding that I have is for lightning protection. My question is, however, assuming that, balancers are not capturing any RF energy radiated off the antenna, barring a situation like that, is there any drawback to having the cable, the shield of the cable, grounded in more than one location? Because the metallic bulkhead and whatnot in the basement that, can easily be, accessible and can be touched. So I want to ground it for safety. I do not want to rely on the shield of the cable to ground it, even though it's, the shield of the cable is grounded 100 feet in the backyard. I want to have a solid ground connection. So my question is there any issue with having the shield of the cables grounded in more than one location? 82HUC. Back to you, Dick.
Comment on that, Dick.
Yeah, John recognized. I did hear you ask that the first time, and it's my fault that I didn't answer that portion of your question, Steve. When that signal is flowing down the center of a coax cable, and the signal is really between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer shield, whether or not that cable is grounded in five places, whether or not it's made into a poor man's balun, where it goes into circles, whether or not it lays against the ductwork for your air conditioning system or the heating system of the house, what you do with the outside of the cable, radio-wise, in almost all circumstances, does not matter. The only slight exception to that is if the antenna itself is an unbalanced antenna and you don't have a balancing device at the antenna, then the outside of your coax cable starting at the antenna can become hot. And now, as the antenna becomes hot, as the coax cable becomes hot, what length of cable between the antenna and the very first grounding point could make that cable become resonant or non-resonant, which is not bad. It just changes the amount of radiation of the cable. But under normal circumstances, when the cable is being used correctly, when you've grounded it in one place or in 40 places, the RF signal is not going to know the difference. If you're feeding your antenna properly, if it's a balanced antenna, or even if it's an unbalanced antenna and you're feeding with the right kind of a balancing device, then the cable is not going to be hot. The signal sees nothing but the center conductor and the inner surface of the shield. It goes down that cable, gets launched by the antenna. After that, it's history and it's off into the ether, it says here. Let's see what John's got to say about that. Wonder how many places your cables are grounded, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW of the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, Dick, got a few. But the most important one, I don't care if you ground at the mast or the tower, where that cable enters your building is where you want a ground rod. And that's where you want to produce the ground. Do not allow the cable to go into the building to a ground bus in there. You do not want to bring any of that static charge or lightning into the house. So the ground rod must be located adjacent to the port entry to the home or the shack. And other ground rods you could have anywhere you want, but that is the most important one. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Good point, John. So that keeps all of the high current, the 11,000 amperes, that's a typical lightning bolt that keeps all outside of the house. From my point of view, where you've got a tower that's a remote from the house and separate grounding of the tower, which could include the cables, that's belt and suspenders. I think it helps because now there's very little chance of the cable from the base of the tower toward the house becoming hot with lightning, with RF, whatever. So when it comes to grounding of coax cables, I don't think there's any amount of grounding that's too much. I see almost no disadvantage of it. But John's point, a very good one, is that try to keep that major lightning grounding and its circuit thoroughly external from the house. There are people who will allow all the cables to come into the house, and then they run a nice grounding rod to a water pipe inside the house. That's not bad. It's just nowhere near as good as it would be if you have a thoroughly external grounding system, as John just described. If somewhat answers the question you're asking, Steve, and if not, you're allowed to ask it again. You got a good question. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Question.
It has a question. So they want to address that when I'm done. That answered my question. And I agree with John. I have multiple ground rods between where the I'm trying to prevent voltage gradients during a strike. It's been my experience that even if lightning doesn't touch what you're trying to protect, the gradient in the ground that's created when it strikes a nearby object is just as damaging as a direct strike would. Noted and already addressed. KD2HUC.
You called it a gradient of a nearby lightning strike. That's true. A more important one, though, is EMP. Turns out that when a typical lightning strike of 11,000 amperes happens a half a block away from you, the electromagnetic pulse that creates, in other words, 11,000 amperes flowing through that lightning bolt, touching some kind of a structure, tree, utility pole, water tower, whatever, that extremely high amount of current for those microseconds makes an extremely strong magnetic field for sure, but let's call it an electromagnetic field, which is now capable of being coupled into any nearby metallic structure, coax cable, antenna, whatever. And the number of feet of cable, because it's picking up some number of volts per feet of wire. So how many feet of wire is exposed to that EMP, and where the nearest grounding for that is, so whether or not any of that gets coupled into the house and into your radio equipment is important. And do worry about the fact that some antennas, when you put an ohm meter between center conductor and shield, do not present a low number of ohms. There's no RF choke in it. A good station master antenna, radio-wise, it'll at the operating frequency, it'll act like 50 ohms. But you put your ohm meter between center conductor and shield of the station master, and you'll measure 0 ohms. In other words, the RF choking characteristic of the way it's built. Let me drop. That RF choking characteristic means that a static charge on the antenna can't be built up. And a well-designed receiver has an RF choke at the input to try to protect it from a static charge. But a static charge buildup on the center conductor can do radio damage. Not a great deal, and fixing it is usually not a great big problem if you damage the very first transistor in the front end of your radio. That's not a showstopper. It's just an annoyance, so to speak. So perfect grounding to protect you from all possibility for lightning. No matter what you do, it's like the best lock and the double bolt lock you put on your door. It'll discourage 99% of the burglars, so to speak. But if a man is really serious and wants to get into your house, like a fireman, if there's smoke coming out of your house, that fireman will get into your house and will find a way to put out that fire, no matter what lock you've got. So nothing is perfect. Lightning is one of those situations no matter what you do, to some degree, it's never enough, if you know what I mean. It's a very difficult situation. I'm trying to remember the name of the company. It's a Nevada company that makes lightning arresters that has a very good book on the subject for $20. I can't think of the name of that company. I wonder if you know the name of the company I'm thinking of, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Wouldn't be Polyphaser, would it?
Give that man a cigar. Polyphaser is the company. Well done, Joe. Paul YY, that was. Polyphaser, you go to their website, they'll sell you a book that used to be $20. It's definitely worth it. It's from my point of view, Polyphaser has spent the last 30 or 40 years gathering all the good information about lightning and lightning protection techniques. So you read that that Polyphaser book on lightning, and you're going to know about the latest and the greatest information on that particular subject. I thank you on that one, Joe. Okay, now, I know that Joe is one of the guys that we can definitely hear very well, so let's take him for the time being. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-W, you got it, Joe.
I got a question.
Why, could I have another nice robust signal tonight?
Give that man a cigar. He's got a nice robust signal tonight, and he can get through. You got it, Joe.
Okay. Okay, well, here's a question for you. With running an oil pump on a burner, and it's a completely different subject, but one you seem to love in the wintertime, does it make any difference running the pressure higher?
Question, please.
Control, I have a question, no.
Pardon me.
Okay, I only heard a portion of that one, Joe. Turns out that when you... What's the name of the company now that makes nozzles? Maybe either you, Joe, or you, John, are going to remember the name of the company that makes a very large manufacturer of the oil-squirting nozzles that we put on the end of the blast tube of our oil burners for our houses, whether it be oil-fired furnace or an oil-fired hot water heater. That particular company, if I can think of the name of it, you go to their website and you download this old 30-page, very well-done manual. It explains the atomization procedure as to what that oil nozzle really does. By the way, although this doesn't sound like ham radio, the really serious ham radio guys are willing to open up the cabinet of their transceiver and repair it if it needs repair, and they're also willing to do their own service on oil burners. Oil burners are it's not rocket science from my point of view. And what this manual will tell you is that almost all oil burners in the past were set, the pump assembly was set for 100 pounds per square inch. And when you read this manual about the company that designs the nozzles that needs the 100 pounds per square inch, they'll make it clear that if you've got the right kind of a gauge, you can buy that from Sid Harvey, a company that sells you the parts. Let me drop.
Would the name be Delvin?
Question.
That's the name of the company, Delrin. You go to the, and by the way, how's Delrin spelled, Joe, while you're at it? Go ahead, Joe.
Amazing how you can just try to talk in here and people insist on stepping on you. Grow a brain, D-E-L-V-A-N.
Well done, D-E-L-V-A-N. You go to the Delrin website and you download the information they tell you about their nozzles. You'll find out that if you raise the pressure, if you've got the right kind of a gauge, and at one time you could buy that gauge for around $20 and plug it into the side of the pump. But anyhow, if you raise the pressure to 150 pounds a square inch by adjusting a screw that's on the side of the pump, which has got the pressure adjusted for 150 pounds per square inch. You get a much higher atomization, much finer spray, so to speak, out of the nozzle. You may have to downsize the nozzle a little bit. If your nozzle used to be 9/10 of a gallon per hour, you may have to go to 0.75 gallons per hour to make sure you're not putting too much oil to air ratio. But the higher pressure of 150 pounds per square inch gives you a much more efficient burn, much higher atomization. In other words, the particles are much smaller and they burn more completely. And when you got it set up correctly, you produce very little soot. Most of the oil burners on Long Island are producing a whole lot of black soot because you're getting incomplete combustion, and a poor air-to-fuel ratio. When you got it set right, you don't develop black soot in your oil burner. It's a tan-colored material. It's just the if you got the right kind of filters in the system. And I Joe found out that I was talking about in the past dual filter, in other words, a coarse filter and a fine filter. And I made the mistake of leading him to believe that there's a structure you can buy that has two filters in it. Not true. I just took two completely separate filter assemblies and hooked up the pipes to cascade me, so that the oil coming from my tank goes to the coarse filter first, the filter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I was saying, my oil goes through the coarse filter first, which is a felt filter. Then it goes into the second canister, one pipe downrange, so to speak, which is this white foam, very fine filter. The advantage of doing that is that the coarse filter takes out the great big chunks of sludge, and the fine filter takes out the fine little particles left over. If you use nothing but the fine filter, you would clog it up in a month. If you use nothing but the coarse filter, some of those fine particles are getting through, and they're creating damage to your nozzle. It turns out if you ever take apart one of these Delvan nozzles, as I have often done, and you look inside, it's a very precise piece of machinery in there with an extremely fine, very well designed structure for swirling the oil, and you don't want fine pieces of dust that's present in the oil to go through there to create artificial wear and therefore damage it. Because the nozzle itself, let me drop. Because the nozzle itself is only a few dollars, and because for it to be in good condition, and it's a wear item, to replace that nozzle once every year is an extremely good investment. Even though it looks good to you, replace it once every year. I think it's about $5-$8, something like that. And but you'll keep the nozzle in much better shape for a longer period of time with that fine filter. I think this is sort of what you're getting at, Joe. And if not, give us more information about what you're discovering. Joe's doing some of this work right now. And another thing old oil burners don't have is the so-called cutoff solenoid. At the instant that your thermostat no longer is demanding heat and the furnace turns off, in the old days, the furnace the oil pump and the blower, air blower, both slow down very slowly. And as they do, oil is dripping out of the end of that nozzle and making a whole lot of sludge. The right way to do it is to put a switch in there, which has got its own built-in delay time, such that when you first turn on the furnace, it delays the opening to allow oil to go into the nozzle. Therefore, you wait until the pump comes up to full pressure and the squirrel cage blower comes up to full speed. Then it opens up with about a 3 or 4 second delay. When the thermostat is no longer demanding heat, and the furnace is turning off, the solenoid turns off immediately, stops the oil flow to the nozzle, and now the oil burner can take its own sweet time, slowing down its blower and slowing down its pump, and you're not creating a unburnt sludge at the end of that nozzle. And so an awful lot of the service that we think we require on our furnaces, soot in all of the flue pipes and sludge built up at the end of the nozzle, is because the solenoid cutoff valve is not there, and the right air-fuel mixture is not there, and not fine enough atomization because not enough pressure, 150 pounds per square inch, going to that nozzle.
Repeater, timeout.
These are the pieces of information that Joe and I have been deriving over the last few years, which when you do it right, an oil burner can be quiet. It doesn't have to be rumbling. It can be giving you a nice clean flame. It doesn't have to be making black soot, and it doesn't have to be making a whole lot of sludge at the end of the nozzle that builds up every couple of months. When things are done correctly, it can be a fairly friendly machine. And there are people who run into those three problems and they give up and flip over to gas. Well, I'm not saying gas is bad, but if you've already got an oil burner in the system, and if you're with a little bit of extra effort and a couple of extra dollars, you can make a hell of a lot more efficiency and cleanliness and quietness out of the system if it's running correctly. Joe and I are making those discoveries, we think. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Once
50. My question, I guess you didn't hear the entire question.
No, didn't hear the entire question. I'm hearing those words for the first time, Joe. And sometimes the words are being cut off. I would not recommend going beyond 150. The Delvan company recommends boosting the normal pump, oil pump, from 100 to 150 because you get finer atomization. And it's a law of diminishing returns. There's a so-called Reynolds number problem. If you had the ability to go to 200 pounds per square inch instead of the 100 or the 150, would you really make a significant improvement? I think the answer is no. Also, by forcing your pump to operate into that much back pressure, I think you're going to run the pump hotter. I think you're going to wear it out faster. Delvan did not recommend it. I do not recommend it. I know that there's an American philosophy. If a little is good, more is better. I mean, the prescription you're taking tells you to take one pill every 12 hours. And if people will say, well, one pill for 12 hours is going to give me a cure, if I take two pills every 12 hours or one pill every 6 hours, that's got to be better. People make the mistake of thinking more is better. In the case of oil pressure, I do not recommend going above 150. I know of nobody who has done it, and I can see a couple of disadvantages of doing it, Joe. So, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W.
Commenting.
That answers that. Part number you gave me, much as an oil pump with the same solenoid as 12 on it. Back to you, Dick.
I'm sorry to hear that, Joe, that it's as expensive as the other post price you were quoted. When I purchased it about 2 years ago, I could go look at my receipts, and I think I paid 20-some-odd dollars. I know that you were recently quoted 70-some-odd dollars, and so a number of items that people do to purchase components for oil burner service, for instance, the so-called blue fluid to get rid of the sludge in the tank, all of a sudden the prices have doubled, tripled, quadrupled. I'm not quite sure why. I'm sorry to hear that that solenoid is that expensive. Let's see what John's got to say. I don't wonder if you do some of your own service on oil burning fixtures, John. KC2 WGB, K2IW, the Tech Man.
KC2 WGB. No, I have a contract, and mine is only a couple of years old, so it's running at top speed and well. By the way, I just wanted to mention that increasing that pressure beyond that recommended 150, that's of wear. You will go through nozzles much quicker. Believe it or not, wearing it out from the light material and grit that it's also being ejected from that port, so that's something to consider. Back to you, Dick, KC2 WGB.
KD2HUC with a comment.
Steve recognized. I'm going to pick you up in a second, Steve. The fine grit that you're talking about that does create wear, and you're saying that wear would happen much more rapidly at the higher pressure, makes a lot of sense. But if you've got the really fine white filter that I'm talking about that takes out the fine grit, I'd like to believe that some of that problem disappears. But that white filter with the fine grit removal capability would, in my case, be clogging immediately. You'd have to replace it every single month if you're not using the coarse filter in front of the fine filter. And so, and another thing that I've got is that the bolt that goes through the canister that holds the filter. And some machines nowadays have the so-called screw-on filter. I do not. I've got the canister that comes apart, which is the filter cartridge you put inside. The bolt that holds that filter together, that canister together. You can buy a bolt that is hollow, and you can put a vacuum gauge on the top of that bolt. Now you can measure the amount of vacuum that your oil pump is of the oil burner is experiencing, and that way you'll know that the pipe from the oil tank and all of the filters are all working correctly. When that vacuum goes up to, let me pick a number, 5 inches of, I think it's 5 pounds per square inch of vacuum, you know that somewhere along the line you've got a partial clog. Either the filter is clogged, one of the two filters is clogged in my case, or the pipe is becoming clogged, and you know to start doing service. You've got a priori knowledge. I mean, the oil burner is not going to stop running until that vacuum goes up to probably 12 pounds per square inches of vacuum. When you see 5 pounds per square inches of vacuum, you've got forewarning. You know that you've got less than a couple of weeks to do some fixing, or otherwise you're going to get a failure. You're not going to get a flame. be able to look at that vacuum gauge and say, hey, I don't have to worry about the fact that the filter has been there for 6 months. I'm running very little vacuum, so the filter is not clogged.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was starting to say, I can see that the filter is not clogged, obvious by the vacuum gauge. So, as you can see, by adding a vacuum gauge, you know that the oil flow is correct. By setting the pressure at 150 pounds per square inch, you know you're getting a cleaner burn. By setting the air-fuel mixture correctly so that, the air is correct. It was, I can't think of his name right now, there was a Limelock member who had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate something like 100 of the oil burners on Long Island, and he found that a high percentage of them are set with a very poor fuel-to-air ratio. Too little air, too much fuel, sooty flame, inefficient, making a whole lot of black soot. He found that a high percentage of the oil burners on Long Island were set that way. If it's true on Long Island, it's probably also true of the nearby states. Whoever is training the oil people are not doing a good job, or they're intentionally setting it that way so that more oil is burned so that they make more profit, because there's a conflict of interest here. The person doing your oil service and the person selling you oil is quite often the very same company, sometimes the very same guy. That does give you, if you think about it, a conflict of interest, something to worry about a little bit. KD2HUC, K2LIW, go ahead, Steve.
Well, two things, Dick. One, there's a good chance that if he cranks the pressure up to, you know, above 150, they don't have the same motors that they used to. The motors were low speed, out of 3/4 horsepower, everything else. Now they're torque, because now they're 3450, they're not the 1725. So, and if the burner is designed for 100 PSI, cranking it up to 200, that added torque, there's a good chance you're going to trip the motor off thermal. And when it's cold and that thing is running and it keeps tripping out, there's a better than average chance his family's not going to be real happy with him. The other thing is, I was curious, since it is, you know, oil burner prep season, I was wondering, I remember last winter we had talked about the outdoor reset system. I was wondering if you or anybody else has installed it. I put one on my boiler about, I want to say 2 years ago now, maybe three, and it's cutting me about 20 to 25% on my annual oil usage. So I was just curious if you guys had looked into it. KD2HUC.
Okay, so to repeat what Steve was saying, because little portions of it didn't come through, the modern-day oil burners, which don't have a real high horsepower motor that's powering both the blower and the oil pump, might not be able to tolerate the 200 pounds per square inch. A second reason not to do it. You get some benefit when you up the pressure from 100 to 150. We have no evidence telling us that you're going to get any greater recent performance. You go to 200, and Steve is telling us that to go to 200 is going to be overstressing that motor in the pump, and again, you're pushing your luck. Now, when you talk about the outdoor cutoff system, I think you're talking about an automatic damper vane inside the flue pipe. You say outdoor cutoff system. I heard those words, Steve, and I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. KD2HUC, K2LIW, the TechNet.
No, Dick, outdoor reset system. That's the one where the aquastat is controlled dynamically based upon the outside air temperature, so that this way, you know, when they do most, you know, housing heat load caps, they figure on 0 degrees and they size the boiler and the radiation in the house, you know, to account for 0 degrees, and usually that once they, you know, use a standard of 200 degree water temperature, at least, you know, most of the houses that were built in the 50s, that's the numbers that they use. Well, obviously you don't need 200 degrees when it's only 50 degrees outside. So they have these computerized controllers that replace the aquastat. I put one on my boiler, and it has a wireless outdoor sensor, and it dynamically adjusts the water temperature of the boiler so that, you know, I mean, if it's 0 degrees out and you need 200, it'll kick the boiler up to 200, but, you know, there's an algorithm that tapers off the temperature, you know, you might only go up to 150 if it's 50 degrees out, and that kind of thing. It's, I've noticed, like I said, around 25% on, you know, savings on my oil consumption over the course of a year. Of course, that's dependent upon, you know, what kind of winter we have. 82 HUC.
I'm very glad you took the time to explain that to us, Steve. That's a new one on me. Joe has been doing some research these days about very fancy controllers, computer-controlled controllers, and quite possibly that function you're describing is a goodie. So for the person who takes domestic hot water from his same furnace that's doing the baseboard hot water heating of the furnace, temperature that the boiler sets itself to should be adjusted as a function of outside air temperature. I can see that. In my case, it's a little bit different because I have a completely separate oil-fired hot water heater as well as my oil-fired warm air house heater, the so-called you would call it hot air, but they call it warm air when you're using oil to fire it. And in my case, my thermostat turns on in order to keep the house at, let me say, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And yes, if I'm a real smart guy, I'm setting the temperature for the oil-fired hot water heater to an appropriate temperature that is not wasting a whole lot of heat. And when it comes to the so-called damper system they've got on the flue pipe, the exhaust system for oil burners, I've got some opinions about that thing and what it's really doing, but I won't get into that one tonight. So you believe you're getting a 25% improvement in efficiency by way of this outdoor temperature setting computer controlled network that controls the temperature of your aquastat, where it doesn't have to be as high when the temperature outside is not so cold, and therefore you're not demanding that much heat out of the house. Let me drop.
ATZ, ready again to give
any
interpretation.
Yeah, but tonight we're not going to be able to hear you, Hal, I'm sorry to say, unless there's something you can do to increase the signal strength. You want to try to repeat what you said earlier? It's up to you. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
H-L-I-W, K6DPZ. I'm putting some very good power in the mobile. Are you hearing me okay, Dick? RIW K6DPZ. RIW DPZ.
Yeah, one of the things that I've discovered is that when many a person has the size of the nozzle for his oil burner much too large in gallons per hour, the net result is that even when you open up the air supply as much as you can't give the right air to fuel ratio, and you tend to get a very large rumble to the flame. I've my particular burner, which I think is rated for 120,000 BTUs per hour, I think it came with either 9/10 or 1.0 gallons per hour, and I've cut it back to 6/10 of a gallon per hour nozzle. As such, my burner runs a little bit longer, which, by the way, is better as far as efficiency is concerned. It's not starting and stopping so often. And also, it runs a lot more efficient as far as oil-to-fuel ratio is concerned. I will admit that when I go down to the lower number of gallons per hour, in the worst-case cold day, if we had a -10-degree day with high wind, the possibility exists that my furnace running full blast would only be able to bring the house up to 65 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a once-per-4-year event. I'm willing to take that risk in order to have a hell of a lot more efficiency and a cleaner burn and a quieter furnace. I'm willing to take that risk. And because I own a number of extra nozzles, on that particular day, I would take the 10 minutes to change the nozzle to the larger number to give me more BTUs. If the family was complaining that 65 degrees is not good enough and they're not willing to wear a coat during that 1 day for 4 years, if you know what I mean. That's my attitude. Not everybody is going to agree with that. Some people are going to say, let me drop. Some people are going to say, I want my furnace to work perfectly all the time. I want it to be sized large enough that on the coldest possible day, it'll give me all the heat I want. Well, you can have that attitude. but you're going to waste a lot of efficiency on all those other days. That's an opinion. Anyone else got any further questions or comments on the subject of oil tonight? Because the heating season is coming up real soon. K2RIW listening.
Quick comment, Dick.
You got it, John.
The gentleman who was talking about the outside weatherman computer, I believe he was only talking about controlling the temperature of the hydronic system. I don't think it had anything to do with the hot water system. That's what he was saying. I didn't know if you had confused that or not.
Well, we're going to turn it back to Steve in a minute for a clarification. I think a high percentage of the hot water fed furnaces on Long Island have a coil in there that gives you domestic hot water out of the exact same boiler. And so therefore, as you change that aquastat setting, you're changing the temperature of your domestic water. I'm one of the rare people who has a thoroughly separate oil-fired hot water heater and a thoroughly separate oil-fired furnace that's giving me heat for the house, which in my case happens to be hot air. Well, they call it warm air. But a high percentage of guys, though, I find, do have a coil in their boiler giving them domestic hot water, as well as the water for the baseboard radiation. I think that's what Steve is saying. Let me turn it over to Steve to make sure we got that correct. KD2HUC for any further comments. K2RAW in the TechNet.
John's got it right. The controller is for hot water hydronic heating. I do have a situation where I have an indirect hot water tank, so my boiler does provide domestic hot water. And the way they address that issue is the controller is programmable and it has programmable inputs. So it differentiates the difference between a coil for heat and a coil for domestic hot water. When there is a coil for domestic hot water, the boiler will go up to full temperature to ensure that the recovery rate of the hot water system is met. It only sets back the boiler temperature for heating, because obviously you certainly don't want to run out of hot water when the outside temperature is too warm. But that is how it works, and just looking at the real dollars, I'm saving about 25% since before I put the controller on. And the controller is actually made by Beckett, so KD2HUC.
Very fine, Steve, and I reason to believe that Beckett's a darn good company. On top of that, I see an advantage here. On a warm summer day, when it's more than 50 degrees outside, and your aquastat is set at a lower temperature, even though that same boiler aquastat is supplying domestic hot water for your shower, so to speak, because at that hot day, the furnace is not demanding heat to be going to the radiators. All of the BTUs coming out of the flame is capable of heating the water, and the only thing that's cooling the water is your coil in there that's giving you the domestic water for your shower or your tub. So under those conditions, even though the aquastat is set at a lower temperature, I think the flame out of your furnace, since it's only supplying hot water for domestic use, not supplying hot water for the radiators, therefore all the heat's going in the right place, your recovery time is so fast that even if it sets down to 150 Fahrenheit, I'll bet you don't have a cold shower under those conditions. I think it all works out correctly. You see what I'm saying on that one, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'd have to be 100% honest with you, Dick. Come May, when the heat is done, I go in and I actually change the high-level set point on the controller down to 150 degrees. The boys at Peerless warned me about lower than 140 degrees because the products of combustion will actually condense on the cast iron and the sulfur forms acid and starts to actually eat the casting. So they say do not run the boiler below 140 degrees. How that works with a cold start boiler, I asked them and they couldn't give me an answer. But that's what they told me. So I run it 150 in the summer. And that's kind of how we handle it. Also, they do have an algorithm in there, and it's actually pretty clever. when the boiler is done with a heating cycle, if the temperature of the boiler is greater than the set point for domestic hot water, it will actually turn the circulator for the domestic hot water on, even though it's not cooling, and dump the extra heat that's in the boiler into the domestic hot water. How much it actually helps, who really knows? I guess it's depends upon how hot the boiler is, at the end of the heating cycle. But it is a little extra thrift that they put in the software. KD2HUC, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me have a couple more words on this one, Steve. I'm getting the impression from what you're saying. I was naively thinking that your domestic water for showers and sink and baths, I was assuming that water comes straight from the street, goes into the coil that's in the boiler, and then comes out. I'm getting the impression from what you're saying that the water coming from the coil in the boiler then goes into a separate storage tank just to make sure that there's enough stored hot water so that if there's a really rapid demand, like somebody is taking two baths in a row, so to speak, that you're afraid that the furnace might not be able to keep up with that. Is that sort of what you're saying, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet?
No, Dick. I have an indirect hot water tank. Basically, what it is, it's a tank with a heat exchanger coil that's piped into the boiler like another baseboard, on its own zone. And the aquastat on the domestic hot water tank fires the boiler and turns on the circulator for that exchanger coil. And basically, the water comes in from the street and enters the tank. There is a separate heating coil. You can't really call it an element, but a heat exchanger coil in the base of the tank that's piped separately from the boiler and is hooked up to the boiler as though it was just another zone of heat. And instead of being controlled by a thermostat, it's controlled by the aquastat on the domestic water tank. It has some benefits because you're not dealing with the high temperature of combustion. They're able to actually use stainless steel. And so the tanks are, guaranteed for a lifetime. They don't really corrode the way the ones with combustion chambers do. KD2HUC.
You just brought up a very good extra point here, Steve. And here I'm in an area where I've been doing an experiment. I'm not sure it's the safest thing in the world, but this is what I've done. I've put a insulating structure on my hot water heater. In other words, my hot water heater, the input pipe and the output pipe goes through a structure that is non-conductive. Therefore, my hot water pipe, my hot water tank is thoroughly isolated from ground. The burner that's firing hot air, the oil burner that fires the hot water heater, it is mounted with rubber gaskets, so to speak. Therefore, although my burner is thoroughly grounded, my hot water tank is not thoroughly grounded. The net result is that I, after 15 years of using that hot water tank, I removed the sacrificial rod inside, thinking that it needed replacement, and it was pristine. It looked like it was brand new, and I'm not getting the normal rusting of the inside of the tank, and the rod is not being sacrificed because the galvanic action that normally takes place is not taking place in my case. My hot water tank is thoroughly floating. As I said, I did that as an experiment. I'm not quite absolutely positive that is a safe thing to do because now that one component in my case is thoroughly ungrounded except for the water supply going through it. But I think since there's thorough grounding on the burner, and there's thorough grounding on the water pipes that go through the house. It's just a hot water tank itself that's floating, but I think it makes a huge advantage in galvanic action. You see what I'm saying on that one, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Comment, Dick.
Am I hearing through, Dick?
Yes, you are, Steve, and John, we'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Steve.
EPZ for a quickie answer. Am I getting through? Yes.